This week on the Special Ed Strategist.
And I think the way that schools talk about this word dyslexia has really evolved over those 25 years. I remember 20 years ago, a parent asking about dyslexia. And I mean, I apologize in advance to any parent I ever said this to. But at the time, we used to say things like, we don't talk about that here in the schools. And like I mentioned, sometimes my favorite tools are in complete alignment with everything I've learned about the student. And I'm like, we have figured this out. All right, we know what we're going to talk about at this meeting. And sometimes my evaluation results are not in, I haven't figured it out. So then it was the question of what program is going to be useful for this student or these students in these grade levels. And so taking a look at from a school perspective, what we need to be doing is, what is our data telling us? Are we doing benchmark testing with kindergarten, first, second grade students where, you know, these skills are so important to really have those foundational skills? Are we checking in on the kids' progress, all of the students' progress, a couple of times a year? But you don't have to agree to anything at the meeting regarding the goals. Go home and think about them. Go home and look at them. Go back and now look at that report again. Look through those present levels. Does this seem like an appropriate place we want to be at a year from now? And if you have questions, go ask for another meeting.
Hello, and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Today, we are joined by Jenny Panzurek, a licensed educational psychologist with over 20 years of experience in psychoeducational assessment and special education. Jenny is nationally recognized for her expertise in identifying dyslexia and other learning disabilities and for training school teams in evidence-based evaluations practices. She also is the host of her own podcast, the Prepared School Psych Podcast, where she shares practical strategies for improving assessments in the IEP process. Today, we're going to explore how parents can work with schools to not only identify dyslexia, but also how to access appropriate interventions. So thank you so much, Jenny, for joining me. I appreciate you coming on, and I can't wait for us to learn so much from you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Wendy.
You bet. So before we dive in, I always ask my guests, what is something that people may not know about you that doesn't necessarily align with not deep, dark secrets? I mean, sure, we all love them, but maybe it's a hobby, a sport, something you used to do that doesn't necessarily have to align with your current career and passion.
That is such a great question. I think off the top of my head, I will say I have a love of learning other languages. I'm not going to say I am bilingual in any sort of way. However, one of the things I love to do when I actually have some time off is go on Duolingo, go on all those different apps. I love learning Spanish, and my newest love has been ASL. I would love to be fluent in both. And I'm just excited to continue learning both of them.
I love that. And that is not the easiest thing, at least for me, to absorb languages. And so I try as well. I have the apps and I try. So maybe you can teach me a few words at some point. Oh, that's another podcast for another day. So let's get to it. Can you start and set our stage by how does one define dyslexia in a way that can really resonate with parents and even educators, just so that they can start to have this lens that we're going to be focusing on?
I think it's a great place to start. And I wanted to kick off, as you mentioned in my intro, like I've been part of this field for about 25 years now. And I think the way that schools talk about this word dyslexia has really evolved over those 25 years. I remember 20 years ago, a parent asking about dyslexia. And I mean, I apologize in advance to any parent I ever said this to. But at the time, we used to say things like, we don't talk about that here in the schools.
Right.
You know, that's a medical diagnosis. And even today, I get to do a lot of trainings, as you mentioned, with school teams around this word dyslexia. And I still have school teams that are like, are we allowed to even use this word? What exactly do we mean by this term? Because there's so many definitions that are swirling out there. And one of the things I like to share is when I have a parent, when I have a teacher, when I have an administrator who says, are we going to look at dyslexia for this student? One of the first things I ask is, There are so many definitions. What do you mean by this term? Because I think there's so many people who still think BD reversals just screams dyslexia. And while some students who have dyslexia may make those reversals, that is not the end all be all when we think about this term. And when we think about how that definition has really evolved, I love the work that the International Dyslexia Association has been doing. And I look at so many states who nowadays have some sort of handbook or guidelines around this term dyslexia. And so many of them have adopted that definition, including my state, which is California. So when we talk about this term dyslexia, again, I have a lot of people who just come in and they're like, I'm actually not even quite certain exactly what the term means. Can you share? So let's break it down. I think when we talk about dyslexia, many people are going to focus on the academic areas of reading decoding, reading fluency, and spelling. I know that sometimes we talk about comprehension issues as well, but when we look at a lot of the definitions, most of them focus on those kind of more basic building blocks. And then, as we know, if we have a student who can't read all the words or is struggling to read any of those words with any sort of fluency, comprehension may be impacted. But typically, if a student is able to accurately decode and fluently read, we usually don't typically include comprehension as part of that general definition there. So the first thing is, what academically are we looking at? And then the second thing is the why behind that difficulty. And that definition from the IDA talks about that it's typically due to difficulties in the phonological component of language. And when we think about that, we think about so many things that so many of our schools are great at screening in those early years. Is a student able to blend sounds together? In our English language, we got to pull those sounds apart and do like segmentation and manipulation of sounds. We need to be able to remember that when we're blending sounds together, that first sound that we said a couple of seconds ago, we have to hold that in our memory and be able to utilize those skills. And then, of course, our rapid naming skills, being able to really quickly and efficiently retrieve that information from our brain. So, we've got the academic piece, we've got the reason why. And again, it says in the definition, it's typically the result of. And I love that they included that word because it means that we get to look at things beyond that. And are there other things? I think one of the other terms that frequently gets brought up when we talk about spelling issues and decoding issues and students be able to memorize high frequency words, which we absolutely need to do in our English language because we have a whole bunch of words that you can't sound out, is also that orthographic processing as well. So we need to understand the academic issues. We need to understand the reason behind those academic issues. And we got to make sure that we're ruling out instructional factors as being a main cause. I think if we learned anything from that amazing podcast, Sold a Story, is that we have, unfortunately, so many schools, even today, that aren't using evidence-based ways to teach reading. So we don't want to walk in and say this kid is struggling because of a learning disability, when in fact it could mainly be that we've not been teaching reading the way we need to teach reading.
And so, how do we move forward with that information then? In terms of you have a team, and as a parent perspective coming in to say, hey, I'm really concerned about this, what are some maybe questions that a parent could ask at an IEP table or before an IEP, just so that they have that understanding of looking at, all right, how is reading taught? How is my baby doing? Where do I even start with this conversation? And especially if we have teams that are still can be confused because of differences with how the interpretation's coming down from state and local agencies, there's a lot of questions there.
There, definitely. Definitely. I think from that parent perspective, one of my first thoughts is always ask questions. So if you are sitting at that meeting or you received a draft copy of a report ahead of time, or maybe you're at the very beginning of the process and we're just sitting down to talk about the concerns that a parent has, feel free to ask questions. Because I know many times educators, these are IEP terms we throw around all the time. And I think sometimes we forget that not everyone knows all of our acronyms. And so feel free, if someone says something and you're like, I'm not quite certain what exactly that means, to ask those types of things. I think it's very okay to ask questions ahead of meetings so that you can feel prepared. What kind of data are we going to be taking a look at this meeting? Is there any way that I can get a copy of that so that I can be an informed member of this team? So being able to ask questions, and then number two, data. Everyone loves some data. Everyone in the school setting loves some data. And data can be, what does the parent see when they're sitting with this student every single day struggling with reading those decodable books or just noticing them struggling through homework? Write those types of things down. I know it can be very overwhelming to walk into a meeting and have like 10 people sitting around this table, and we kind of forget all of those things that we were like, I'm going to bring up this, this, and this at the meeting. And then we're a little overwhelmed because there's so many people there. So writing down those observations and kind of keeping track of those things. So what are those questions that you want to make sure get answered in this meeting? Bring out that question list at the meeting and go, I have these questions, and cross them off or write them down, and don't leave that meeting until those questions are answered. So going back to, what curriculum are we using here in this school district, right? It might not even be this exact place, but what is the school district? What English language arts curriculum have we adopted? You know, what is the emphasis? Is the emphasis on phonics and phonemic awareness, which again is what we're looking for? Or are we using some, you know, curriculum that maybe needs to be retired?
You brought up excellent points. And I always say that, you know, as a parent, when you walk into an IEP meeting, it's like a party and the music stops and everybody looks at you, whether it's intentional or not. And it can just feel like, whew, and you become the little frog in the cartoon from a long time ago that just stops, ribbit, ribbit. And then, you know, you have a lot to say, but you just, it can be very overwhelming. And I talk a lot about collecting data as a parent so that you can then be empowered. And I'm glad that you brought that up as well. Whether it's taking a little video of your kiddo reading, whether you have a pen and paper doing it or a digital way to do it that way, so you can then have your data as well, so that you can really be that active member of the IEP team that we all love to have at our IEP tables.
Absolutely. And I think when parents are walking in, I mean, parents sometimes see a slightly different version of that child, of course. So if we see that the parent's data is maybe not 100% aligned with the school data, then I might, again, ask some follow-up questions. Okay, this is what I see in homework. You're not seeing this. So what are you guys doing here in the school? You know, is there some other strategy that maybe you're using during small group time that I could then be implementing when I'm sitting one-on-one with homework? So anytime we have that misaligned data, I don't want anyone to think that, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, I don't want anyone to think like anyone's walking in with an untruth. This is our truth of what we're all seeing. So if we're seeing that misalignment, asking again those follow-up questions of trying to discover, what is it that you're doing? What is it that I'm doing? So that we can figure out, where is that hole or where is that link that needs to be discussed, so that we're all using strategies that maybe someone else has seen has been very helpful for this student.
Yeah, and then it also creates this space of true communication and collaboration, right? And so, and having that and supporting each other and not feeling like you're in a silo of what's happening, I think it's an excellent point. Can we then take a second and talk about some critical components in a comprehensive dyslexia evaluation so that parents can better advocate for their kiddo, right? And we always think about bell to bell and educational impact. And how can that really, how can we then take that approach of looking at this student and thinking, and so as a parent, that they can then start to say, oh, are we testing for this? Can we test for this?
So I'm going to go back to one of the words that you started with comprehensive evaluation, because a lot of times, and you know, my background is also as a school neuropsychologist, I love a good standardized test. Absolutely. And what we know is standardized testing is just one component of the evaluation. And that's why we don't just have a kid come in, take a test with us, and then have a meeting, because we need to look at that data alongside all of the other pieces of information. Sometimes students are coming in during that standardized testing and may perform very differently than what we're seeing in other spaces, which again is why I talked about like that alignment or misalignment of data. So we're talking to anyone who will talk to us. We're talking to the general education teacher. If this is a reevaluation, talking to the special education teacher. If the student happens to be in an intervention program, how are we gathering data from that person as well? How are we gathering information from the parent? So that when we are looking at standardized testing results, hopefully all of the people involved in that are taking a look and saying, most of the time, what I like to think of as, well, of course we got these results. That makes complete sense, because that's what all of these five other people that I've been talking to, plus all of these report cards previously, for me, many times standardized testing results are just that extra piece that just ties everything up into a nice little bow. I don't want anyone to go into meetings and all we do is talk about test results. Test results is just one piece. And I think sometimes, and again, when I reflect back at my early years in this field, I'm going to raise my hand and say, I talked a lot about test results. And if we don't have those other pieces of information, we don't have the context in which to interpret those results. Otherwise, I could get a kid on just a bad day. What if they walked into my room to do testing with me and they just got into a fight with their best friend on the way into my office? Like, those aren't the most valid results. So that's why we want to make sure that teams are talking about at our meetings, yes, I gave this test and this is what the score is, and hopefully this is what this score means. But this is also consistent with all of these other sources of data. So going back to what kind of evaluation might we look for, it's going to go back to that definition. So if we know that usually when we use the word dyslexia, we're talking about decoding issues and fluency and spelling, then we want to hear about that. Whether that's the school psychologist who's doing that evaluation or a special education teacher. And again, we want to make sure that we're not just going into meetings and say, I gave this fill in the blank test and your kid's score was this, which is in the below average range. Like, what does that mean? What is that student actually able to do and not able to do? Because evaluation is so important. It's going to set the stage for this IEP meeting. It's going to set the stage for the present levels in the IEP document. And if all we have are scores, that makes it very difficult for a parent, much less a gen ed teacher or anyone else sitting around the table, to truly understand where is the student at right now. So we'll want to make sure academically we've got some good data. And then, like I mentioned, a lot of times it may be like a school psychologist who's also coming in and looking at those phonological processing skills, looking at those orthographic processing skills, looking at memory skills, and any other area that we think is important based on, number one, all the questions we asked everyone before we even opened up any sort of testing protocol. And number two, what did we find along that way? Because again, sometimes I'm going to start with some of my favorite tools. And like I mentioned, sometimes my favorite tools are in complete alignment with everything I've learned about the student. And I'm like, we have figured this out. All right, we know what we're going to talk about at this meeting. And sometimes my evaluation results are not in, I haven't figured it out. And so that's when I might need to dig a little bit deeper for me to figure out, I don't want to miss anything. I don't want to miss any other reason why this student may be struggling. Makes me think about a student I was evaluating, and she was struggling with reading. There was no question about that. Parents had brought in an outside evaluation that demonstrated that. Our evaluation completely confirmed that. But I couldn't figure out from my favorite tools that I started with why the student was struggling, because her phonological processing was completely intact. All those interventions the school did, all of that tutoring that parent did, all of it helped this kiddo. And she was able to blend and segment and all of those different things. And then I thought, oh, orthographic, I'm going to figure it out. No, she did beautiful on all of that. And so for some of our students, we don't want to just give one type of test and call it a day, because for some of our students, that student, I needed to dig a lot deeper. And for that student, it was beyond just what we typically look at for learning disabilities. And there were some social emotional factors that were part of that conversation. As we can imagine, students who struggle with reading can have a lot of feelings about that, from anxiety to self-concept issues. And this student ended up having a lot of anxiety anytime she was asked to read. And what we know from the brain is when we're anxious, our brain's cutting off all of our key ability to do things like blend and segment sound. Even though in isolation, I can do those tasks, when you're asking me to do something that causes me a lot of stress, as we both know, when we're in stressful situations, we kind of forget all of our learning. And we have to kind of deal with that anxiety first. And so that was a big component for this student, that the testing results weren't going to highlight. That was something else we needed to dig deeper into to really figure out why was this student struggling.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And my head is just like with ideas and thoughts. Because from the IEP side and the parent coaching side, from what I help support parents do, different than the neuropsych testing that you do, is really helping parents kind of think through, right? Instead of just coming in, I have my kid has a problem with reading. It goes back to that data that parents can collect at the home and the community, so that with a strong team, we can start to say, okay, let's ask these questions. And just even as that special educator on the team, where do you like just really trying to dig as much as we can so that we then can assess areas with that knowledge of we can still dig deeper if we need to, so that we can really understand that processing memory and attention as it relates to an educational setting, so that we can really look and find and hone in, what are those needs? And we know that needs are going to build our goals, which are going to align with our services. And so having that strong springboard of really taking a moment. So kudos to you. We need more Jennies in the world that can just say, all right, hold on. All right, I got some answers, but I feel like, and I know that's, we talk about data, but I think, when you're really good at practitioner, you also have just that sense, right? That unidentified sense that you're like, there's something more happening, and let's keep digging so that we can really look at a whole child to then have improved outcomes.
Absolutely.
So we did set the stage with kind of a definition, but there's also a confusion for families about a clinical definition and then how schools go about identifying it, right? So we have our medical model, and then we have IDEA that really helps schools kind of go about their procedures. So can you just help us unpack that difference between the clinical definition of dyslexia and then how a school would identify specific learning disabilities under IDEA, and how can parents kind of understand those two models?
And I'm so glad you're bringing this up, because I think it's very confusing. I think it's very confusing that there are two different models that are being used, but it is what it is. And so for right now, we have the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, and that's what I always refer to as outside professionals, outside of the school system. So doctors may be using that. I have a small private practice. So when I'm in my private practice hat, I get to also use the DSM to make diagnoses. And the word dyslexia is in that big book. It's under specific learning disorder. It says otherwise known as dyslexia, again, as it relates to those reading, decoding, and fluency concerns. Now, one of the things that can be different, and this is going to add to the confusion here, when we go to the school setting, we have to take into consideration any outside diagnoses, but that does not align 100% with how IDEA, so from a national perspective, as well as a state-by-state perspective, how we're looking at learning disabilities. And so it's even difficult for me to say, like, every school district is all using the same definition of learning disability. And from state to state, we're all doing it the same because we're not. For many, many, many years, we were all in all of our states using what is referred to as the discrepancy model, where we would take a look at the student's overall intelligence, cognitive level, and state to state, we were subtracting that from the numbers we would get from those academic tests. And in some states, we needed a 20-point discrepancy. And in some states, we needed a 15-point discrepancy. And in some states, they were like, I don't really like those numbers. Let's just come up with some other numbers. That alone varied state to state. But back in 2004 is when IDEA said states no longer had to use the discrepancy model, which was, for many of us, a huge relief because we weren't really big fans of that. And so IDEA allowed states to make decisions. Do you want to keep the discrepancy model? Do you want to use what is referred to as an RTI or response to intervention model? Or do you want to use another research-based model, which is typically referred to as a pattern of strengths and weaknesses model? So state to state, some states only allow one of those three models. I practice in California, we're allowed all three of those models. And so again, there's going to be some differences in how schools are looking at learning disabilities. I will say for my practice in my state, how we're looking at learning disabilities versus how that DSM diagnosis, one of the big differences is that in an outside evaluation, the why behind those reading difficulties isn't like a huge focus in regards to those processing skills. Like I keep talking about like the phonological or the orthographic. But in California, most of our school districts do require that under learning disability, under IDEA and our regulations in our state, that we have to find the reason why. And if you're eligible under learning disability, it's because of a processing problem. It's not instructional factors. And as we know, it's not hearing, it's not vision, it's, you know, all those other things that we're ruling out. So one of the things that I like to share with families, especially when they're walking in using that term, if they're walking in and they've had a private evaluation outside of the school system and they have a piece of paper that has that dyslexia diagnosis, one of my jobs or my team's jobs is to make sure that the family knows at the beginning, and I usually repeat it a couple of times, you have this, and they are using this classification system. This is our classification system. So again, because it varies a little bit state by state, what I say here in California might not be exactly what I might say in your state. But I will say, oh, wow, thank you so much for that report. I noticed they found very low reading scores. The student has very average skills in many areas when we think about her cognitive or processing ability. But what I didn't see in that report is something we are required to do. I didn't see in that report the reason why she's struggling with reading. And so that's something that we're going to need to do. And so I'm going to bring up that differentiation right at the beginning with the families in a very similar way that many of our states, if we have a family who has an outside diagnosis of autism, many of our IDEA definitions of autism are also different than the DSM. So there's a couple of instances where we have families who are walking in using terms or having outside diagnoses that I feel like it's important for the school to do that education at the beginning. This is the difference here in this state, or in states like mine that allow three different models. This is the difference here in our district. This is how we have to look at learning disability. And I think one of the other differences I want to highlight as well when we talk about the DSM versus IDEA and special education, all of our areas of eligibility, whether we're talking about learning disabilities or autism or more emotional concerns, we are always required to say whether or not the team believes this child requires special education. Whereas in the DSM, you could have like a severity level 1 learning disorder that might not require specially designed instruction. It may be that those wonderful curriculum going on in general education, those interventions that general education is able to provide, for some of our students who may have that outside diagnosis of dyslexia, their needs may be able to be met within general education. So one of those components, again, every single area of eligibility, does the student require? And that's a big thing to be talking about. I know we want to provide services to students who, of course, require that. That is a discussion for all of the team members. It's a little bit different in, again, that private or outside of the school system world.
When a parent comes to you and asks the question of, should I have my kiddo's evaluation be completed through the school system free of charge, or should I go outside? What is your answer?
So, as I mentioned,
which
I have
is
my
hard,
private
right?
Practice.
Because I mean, especially that you are on both sides
yes.
with that. And so I'd love to hear your answer before I give my 2 cents.
Yes. Anytime K-12, I have a parent who in my private practice comes to me and says, I'm interested in an evaluation. Ethically, my first thing to tell every family is, you know that you can get this for free from your public school. So I always make sure that is in there. It's in all my paperwork. I want to make sure that parents understand, and some parents are unaware of that. And many of the families that end up contacting me tend to be families that maybe are in private schools. They know they could go to their public school, but many families are like, I'm just looking. I have families who I just want to know personally. I don't even want the school to know that I'm doing this evaluation. I just want to know how to help this kid at home. So they don't want to even bring the school into it. I have other families who are saying, well, we're just looking for some accommodations at the private school, and they require this other evaluation to document the need for that. And again, I'll say, you know, the public school will do that for you. And many of the families choose to just go, you know, in that private route, which is their decision. I think one of the things that's important to know is that for our families who are still attending public schools and for our families who want services from public schools, you may decide to get that evaluation from someone outside the school district. But in many states, again, I'm not going to be in charge of all 50 here in this conversation. In many states, if a school receives that outside evaluation, we're going to look at it, we're going to consider it, but we're still probably going to do our own evaluation. And so I think sometimes parents have this thought that, oh, here's the pieces of paper, it's already been done. Can we just get an IEP? And that's not how most school districts work. And so we usually are still going to have our 50-day, 60-day timelines and still have to go through those different pieces. So I just want to make sure parents are very informed. And these are pros and cons for all of these different sides. And what would you like to do at this time?
Yeah. And I think knowledge is power, right? And
absolutely.
And having those conversations with parents, and I do the same thing of, this is what it can look like, and here this and this, and just so, you know, making that informed decision as a parent of what makes most sense for them, but to have all the information. You brought up RTI. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about that and just kind of thinking about early indicators that a parent should look for that maybe could suggest something going on? And then, you know, at what point would you recommend a parent to say, all right, let's move forward, you know, requesting that formal evaluation? Or, you know, do they wait out RTI to go through all of it? Let's hear it. Let's do it.
I love anything that's going to promote early intervention, because as we all know, early intervention is key in so many cases, including reading concerns. And I think it's one of the downfalls that many states were feeling about learning disabilities under IDEA and the discrepancy model is kids had to be really, really, really far behind. And so we weren't able to provide a lot of that early intervention to the students. So I always promote, what can we do first in general education for all of our students who are struggling? So with our schools who have some great intervention programs, I've been able to be a part of schools where, you know, we might have had this one teacher who did some interventions. I think one of the things to, again, we're going to go back to knowledge is power and what kind of questions are we asking? If you know your school has an intervention program for reading, whether that's being done, you know, being pushed into the general education setting, maybe even provided by the gen ed teacher, or this is an out, you know, students leave that classroom and get that small group support. What does that look like? Are they using a specific curriculum? What is that curriculum's name? How many kids are in this program? How are we monitoring progress in this program? Because those are the questions that I want to ask when I'm working at a school. I remember being at an elementary school for a number of years and asking my principal, hey, in room 12, we have this intervention teacher. What is she doing with the kids? And my principal was like, let's go talk to her. And we went down together. And she was doing amazing things, but there was no set curriculum. She was just pulling in things based on this one teacher said, could you help them finish that homework they didn't get finished? And this other teacher was like, yeah, they didn't finish this classwork. It wasn't a structured program. And for us at that school, what we realized was we needed a structured program. So then it was the question of what program is going to be useful for this student or these students in these grade levels. And so taking a look at from a school perspective, what we need to be doing is, what is our data telling us? Are we doing benchmark testing with kindergarten, first, second grade students where, you know, these skills are so important to really have those foundational skills? Are we checking in on the kids' progress, all of the students' progress, a couple of times a year so that we can kind of flag, this is a group of students who need some support, and then we can figure out what is the support they need? Because not every single student needs the same exact intervention program. Some students have really great blending and segmenting skills. They're still just so disfluent. They just need so much more repeated readings. And they might not be appropriate to be sitting in the same intervention group for a kid who still doesn't know that this letter makes this sound. So really trying to differentiate, what are we noticing about these students' needs here? How can we provide that within general education? And then how are we monitoring that progress? So if I was that parent and I'm hearing your kid is in one of our intervention programs, awesome. What curriculum is being used over there and how are you monitoring progress? So
also,
those are the, go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah. And also, how are you going to communicate that progress to me as a parent? Like, how am I going to get that information and how can I communicate? Yes.
Exactly. How can we make sure, because I'd want to know, how often are we getting progress? How often are we collecting that data and how are you informing parents? Is that a letter that everyone gets? Is that something I need to schedule, send an email in 3 months? Like, how are we going to be doing this kind of information here? I think the very interesting piece when we talk about RTI, and I remember when it became like really exciting in all of our schools and we're all going to do this, what ended up happening in some of our schools was parents would come in and say, I have a concern. And we'd be like, yeah, you're not through all the tiers yet. So we can't do anything until you're at the top tier. And then thank goodness the Department of Education was like, you're not allowed to say that. Like, we actually have a memo from the Office of Special Education Programs that says you can't delay an evaluation just because you haven't gone through all these tiers. If anyone truly suspects a disability, we could still be in the middle of those tiers, and we need to be doing that evaluation. Now, that evaluation, in theory, is going to look at how the student is doing in all those tiers. So even if we're doing that evaluation, it may say, yeah, your student is struggling. However, this intervention that your student is in is actually the answer. Like, your student is actually making very appropriate progress for this program. And if we keep going, we expect the student to make this kind of progress by the end of the year. So when we talk about, like, should a parent delay, what I will always tell a parent is raise your hand and ask some questions. Ask for a meeting. Have, whether it's another parent-teacher conference, or most schools have some sort of system in place. We have lots of names for them, like a student study team or a child study team or a child success team. We have lots of names. Ask for one of them and just say, I just want to know how the student is doing. Is the student making the kind of progress that you guys are expecting in this program? When might you determine as a school that this program isn't working for this student and maybe evaluation is the next step? And then again, that collaborative piece with the school, I think, is very key. But if you feel like, because as a parent, you get to request it at any time. So if you're go to that meeting, you're doing that collaboration, and then you're not satisfied with that information, you can always still request, always in writing, always the best way to do it. And ask for that evaluation. And then be cautious if someone says, no, thank you to that evaluation request. Be really clear on why are they saying no, thank you to that request. Because again, there's always information in that letter that says no, thank you, that says if you disagree with this decision, these are the next steps to take. So really be aware of all of your rights and be in those, collaborative conversations, but you still are the best advocate for your child.
1,000%. And that's really why I created Cracking the Code to help empower parents as well, knowing, what their rights are and how to ask and how this, because it is overwhelming. It's overwhelming. It was overwhelming for me, and I have a background in special education. So the whole process can be very overwhelming. But I hope somebody is furiously writing down the questions that you are saying so that they can then move forward with what they are seeking for their individual kiddo. So once the dyslexia, or once dyslexia is identified, right? So how can parents then ensure, I guess, for you, if you had a magic wand and you could create some goals, we don't have to like really lay them out all as SMART goals, but what are some things that you would encourage parents? I know that's kind of it's a hard question, right? Because we're talking about needs and different elements with dyslexia, but what are some goals that you think, okay, I've seen these and these are really powerful goals if this matches with a child? I know that's a big question.
And that's, I think that's one of those interesting things, whether we're talking about goals or a list of accommodation ideas. I think we have to be cautious about looking at something like the Google is one of the most amazing resources we have. And they're going to say, here's, 10 possible goals if your child has dyslexia. And does your student need all of those goals? Where exactly is your student at? And so when we think about that individual component, and I know you talk about this and I've talked about it already as well, that present levels piece on our IEP document is going to be that foundational piece. And that's why for me, present levels can't say on reading decoding, the student got a score of 75, which is in the below average. Like you can't write a goal based on that. And so again, let's go back to, does your student need decoding goals? Does your student, did we find out that there's blending concerns, but your student is great in these other ones? Okay, these are the things I want to be listening for if I was coaching a parent. Like, what exactly are you hearing or did you read in that draft report? I would just be making that list. I would be making that list as they're reviewing results and just be like, all right, they said that was an area of struggle, was decoding, or that was an area of struggle. They still don't know their high frequency words. And when we get to that goals, I would just go through my list. I would literally have a piece of paper in the meeting and then be like, okay, I made this list of needs as you guys were discussing all of this. Am I missing anything? Like, these are the needs we're going to address in these goals, correct? Or for some of our students, we have a list of 15 needs. And for a lot of our students, having 15 different goals might not be appropriate. We got to figure out where's that first domino that we're going to be focusing on in order to knock down some other dominoes. So, for example, some of our students are struggling to be able to read quickly because they still can't read all the words. And so, writing a fluency goal that the students can be able to read at 50 words per minute, but they still can't read the words on their own, it might be too soon to work on that goal. We don't want to set up the student for failure on their goals because we just want to have a goal in everything. So where exactly are we at? And we want to make sure we're really clear about the baseline of that goal. Where's the student currently at? I will say, when I do trainings on IEPs for school teams, there's this magical percentage that we always feel like every student has to be at 80% for mastery for every single goal that exists. And I understand for most areas, 100%, most gen ed students don't do things 100% of the time. However, if a student's current percentage is 25%, 80% a year might be asking way too much, depending on the learning rate that we hopefully have some information about for this student. Whereas other goals, it may be very appropriate to have it be higher than 80%. So I think keeping in mind all of those different pieces, again, you're an advocate for your student as the parent. So walking in and asking those questions, reviewing those goals. And then what I always like to tell parents is you don't have to sign anything at that meeting other than that you were at the meeting and that hopefully you received your procedural safeguards. We usually like that you wrote that, you signed off on that one. But you don't have to agree to anything at the meeting regarding the goals. Go home and think about them. Go home and look at them. Go back and now look at that report again. Look through those present levels. Does this seem like an appropriate place we want to be at a year from now? And if you have questions, go ask for another meeting. Because I think a lot of times there's a lot of pressure. Again, we got all these people sitting around the table staring, and we're like, do you agree? Do you have any questions? And it's just too overwhelming for most people to make really important decisions about their children right then and there. So I always love to tell parents, whether I'm coming in more as an advocate or coming in as a school team member, you don't have to say yes or no right now. Now, we can't go forward with everything until you say yes or no to this. But if you need time to think about it, I want you to take time to think about it. I want you to go home. I want you to look at this information. I want you to see. And if you're like, could you explain to me again why we are not going with a fluency goal? Because I know that that was an okay. Rent, thank you for that reminder. Go ahead and ask those questions so that you feel really comfortable with this really important document that's laying the foundation for what we're going to be doing with this student.
And how important is that to then say to parents about asking for that draft IEP and so that you can start to look at, all right, I've submitted my parent input statement. This is what the present levels are looking like. Okay, these are the suggested goals. You know, we're not predetermining anything, but just for you as a parent to then ask questions, you know, reach out to you, reach out to me, and just kind of start to put all of this together, tying it back to that original. Why, right? So you may have a diagnostic code or you've been found eligible, but then what is the why behind that so that you can start to thread that into the accommodations goal supports for your kiddo?
Absolutely. Again, if we find that the student is still struggling with blending and segmenting skills, those are things we can work on. We can improve upon those skills. And so I would expect to see that, you know, expressed in the goal somehow. Now, if a student has a memory concern, I don't know how to go into a kid's brain and fix and, you know, improve memory. There's some strategies, there's some compensatory things, but for many kids with memory concerns, I'm going to see that showing up on the accommodations page. And we're going to see like how, again, that's an area of need that I wrote down. Whether I looked at draft stuff or I was listening to you during the meeting, you guys kept saying memory was an issue. How is that being addressed in this IEP? Because you're saying that's the key reason why the student is struggling with decoding and fluency. So how are we addressing that piece in this IEP document?
Now we talked a little bit about goals, right? What other things should parents advocate for? And you kind of did bring up some accommodation pieces and services. What are some things that parents may not know about that they can start to ensure some implementation of some strong supports?
We'll start with accommodations since we were just talking about that. I think that there's a lot of accommodations that, again, that we talk about at meetings that may be appropriate for the student. But some accommodations we just write down and we may have a discussion at the IEP meeting. But I think having the clarity on that accommodation is going to be super helpful. These are two that I hear a lot: preferential seating and extra time. Preferential seating can mean five different things for five different students. Preferential seating for some students is close to the front of the classroom and to the point of instruction. Some kids need some wiggle room, and it's easier for them to be on the side or in the back so they're not disrupting the learning of others if they need to get up and move around. If we have a student who have a hearing or a vision concern, preferential seating means something totally different. And so when you see accommodations like that, maybe on a proposed or a draft IEP, I would want as much as possible that clarification right then and there. Preferential seating close to the point of instruction, or preferential seating close to the front of the room. Like, what exactly does that mean? Because I don't know how gen ed teachers do that because they're going to come in and gen ed teachers are going to have five kids who all have IEPs, two kids with 504 plans. They all say preferential seating. If there's no clarification, they don't know where to seat that kid. They know they're supposed to think about it, but they're not quite certain what does that exactly mean. Extra time. Of course, a lot of our students who are still struggling with reading or reading quickly may need extra time. But how much extra time? Because again, this student may go in and one teacher's like, that means as much time as they need. And another teacher's gonna be like, I only have so much time in my day that, I'm only giving them an extra, time and a half. And another teacher sees that as twice as long. So when you're in that meeting and someone says extra time, I would ask the question, what do we mean by that? What do we mean by that for this student? Is that the same for assignments as it is for testing quizzes? Like, how can we make sure that that is very clear that if this kid got up and moved to another state tomorrow, that team can pick up this IEP and they know exactly how to implement it? And that's that key piece. When we look at goals, I'm just going to say so many of our schools, of course, have some beautiful goal banks. We've got that list. It's hard to think of goals off the top of our heads sometimes. However, sometimes those goals, we read them out loud and everyone's like, I don't know what that means. I don't even, what would that look like? So if you as a parent or you as a gen ed teacher are sitting there like, I don't even know what that means, ask that question. What might this look like? Do we need to add clarity into that goal? I think one of the things that so much of the research, of course, is pushing that early intervention, but that we're using evidence-based programs with kids. And especially with IEPs, a lot of times there's hesitation to put in a name of a program. And logistically, there's a reason for that. Number one, let's go back to the example, the kid moves. What if they move to a district that doesn't have that program, right? So we want to be really clear about that. But the other piece is, what if that program doesn't end up working for this student? Like, if there was this one evidence-based intervention program that solved every kid with dyslexia, it solved all of their issues, I think we'd all be using it. I don't think a single person who works in the school is trying to keep kids down. Like, we all want kids to read. And I have seen some amazing programs work for a huge percent of kids. And then have this other student who made no progress in that program. So I think that that's one of the things sometimes when people say, like, why aren't you writing down this specific name of the program? Well, we don't want to get into that and then decide this isn't working. We need a lot of that flexibility, especially in special education, to say, hey, we realize we need to supplement with this, or this program didn't work. So we needed to shift gears. And I'm not going to wait till the next annual to do that. The kid needs to shift gears right now. So instead of a lot of times, many schools are going to hesitate to put the name of a program down. What are the key components of the program that we're looking for that student? So key terms that we hear a lot, that evidence-based, the multi-sensory approach, we're making sure it is going to hit all of those different pieces. If we find out your student's struggling in blending and segmenting, let's make sure there's phonics in that approach over there. We want to make sure that's included there. So, what are those key pieces that are necessary for this student to benefit from this specific intervention program? Let's make sure if the school doesn't want to write down the name of something, let's just be really clear with what kind of strategies or what kinds of interventions are going to be key for this student based on the hours of evaluation we just completed. Like, we have all this information. Let's use this information not just to determine yes, no on eligibility, but use that information to figure out what does this student actually require now to make progress on those goals.
Have you seen any kind of out of the box school-based strategies that you're like, wow, that I've not seen that over the years, but that has really worked? And again, I know all of our conversations are putting these blanket general questions out, and each kid is so individualized, but I was just curious.
I think one of the things that I have noticed a lot more lately is there's so much research about our kindergarten, first grade, second grade students who are struggling with reading and the type of interventions that are really appropriate for them versus our kids who are in middle school and high school. Sometimes, again, because every student's unique, sometimes the same exact intervention program may be very useful, but there's a lot of research to show that, like, after a certain age, we might need to approach it a little bit differently. And so that would be something I would be thinking about if I was a parent and I'm going to my meeting for my eighth grader. Are they using this program? Like, what's the actual effectiveness that the research has shown of this program for students in this age range? Because again, a lot of times these very, phonological based programs are very appropriate for the little ones, but there's a lot of information that we kind of have a different approach for those older students. And so are we taking that into consideration as we are building this program for this student? I would be very cautious about saying, well, our entire district, K through 12, uses just this one program and we never deviate from that. Well, I'd love to know, do we see the same type of growth when we have a first grader who's doing this program versus an eighth or ninth grader doing this program?
Excellent point. As we wind down, what is one thing that I didn't know enough to ask that I should have asked you?
So we've talked a lot about that parent piece of asking those questions and really being part of that collaborative conversation. I think one of the things that can be very useful that I don't know if every school team member knows, and I think it's important for parents to know as well. We talked a little bit about some guidance documents that have come from the US Department of Education. There is a document that is referred to as a Dear Colleague Letter from 2015 that indicates the answer to the question that a lot of us had in the schools, which was, are we allowed to say dyslexia in this meeting? Are we allowed to write about it in our report? Because as I mentioned, 25 years ago, someone said that I was like, we don't do that here. And so there was clarification. It took a while for us to get that. But that document specifically states you're allowed to say it. You're allowed to use it. You're allowed to say it. And if you think it would be helpful to bring it up, please bring up these terms. And so I think that if there's a parent out there who's like, my school's still not saying that word. And then that document also talks about dysgraphia. And I'm just going to say the math one. I hear dyscalculia pronounced three different ways. So I always just refer to it as the math one because, yeah, lots of different ways to pronounce that word. And so I think it's important that if you as a parent are going to a team meeting and they're like, we're not allowed to say that word, I would bring that piece of paper. It's only about 3.5 pages long and make sure the team has read that. As a team member, I will say, I did a training not too many weeks ago that some of the team members still didn't know we were allowed to do that. So should we all know these things? I hate to shut on everybody. Some people know and some people don't. So let's just give everyone the benefit of the doubt that maybe they hadn't read that document. And so I don't think parents need to be in charge of educating this school, but sometimes we need to share all the information so we're all on that same page. So I would say take a look at that Dear Colleague document from 2015.
Final question, if you had a billboard with one tip for a parent, what would it be and why?
I would say, and we've already talked about asking questions, I would say ask somebody else. And this is what I mean by it. A lot of times you're there as the parent and you are there as the representative of your family for this child. And like you said, sometimes we're supposed to be having these collaborative conversations at IEP meetings, but sometimes you're feeling like you're the person on that side. And so whether that's your bestie, whether that is someone you know who works in education, like if you're having questions, like go ask somebody. Go ask somebody else. Just to have that talk through of, is there anything else that you're not thinking of? Or, I think about in a lot of our classrooms, they're the ask three before me. So, like, go and ask other people. You don't have to do this alone. So, if whether that's a formal advocate or something like that, just go ask somebody else. If you're feeling like, I keep saying this over and over again, but the school doesn't seem to be hearing, like, sometimes we're like, am I not saying it right? How are you hearing this? So I always like to have another person that I can bounce my ideas off of. So ask somebody else.
Fabulous. Fabulous. And how can folks find you?
My website's the easiest way. It's just my name, jennyponzurich.com. There's lots of different resources there for parents as well as school teams on topics like dyslexia as well as learning disabilities, some of my favorite conversations to have.
Beautiful. This has been such a pleasure. I know folks are going to come check you out, listen to your podcast, all of the good things. So I appreciate your time today and chatting with me. And I know that you're paving the way forward for a lot of parents. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. This has been a great conversation.
You bet. Bye for now. Thanks for tuning in to the Special Ed Strategist. Remember, the right support can make all the difference. As your dedicated Special Ed Strategist, I'm here to guide, collaborate, and empower your kiddos' success. Keep igniting potential one step at a time. Until next time, take care and keep strategizing. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com.